Discussion. Who is in charge of my inner genius? And this is discussion five. Discussion four. And so five will come in an hour or a half hour. So we have some questions?
Yeah.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you. Please, what can you tell us about life after death? Is there really another realm where people who have passed on exist? Well, that's a very good question. And as far as you're concerned, and as far as I'm concerned, I'm the answer man. I have the answer for us. The question is there life after death? And the answer is no. There is no life after death because death is the end and finality, and there's nothing more. Now, is there life after life? Yes. Do we die at death? We put aside... Do we put aside our physical body? Yes. But does our spirit die? Does our soul die? Does our mind die? Does our consciousness die?
No.
Whoever thinks that whatever is their real quality dies. Now, I have a friend who lost a leg. And so he had to have a prosthesis. He had a prosthesis or whatever. He had to have a false leg. And he had a false leg put on, and so now he can walk around with this false leg. It will move a little bit for him, and he can walk with it. Now, what happened to the real leg? What happened to the leg that was taken off? Where did it go? Did the spirit and soul decide they're going to abandon that part that they're not using anymore? The spirit and soul were never in that leg in the first place. Your spirit and soul is never in your body in the first place. Your body is a temple of the living God. A temple. Does God exist only in the temple in which it has as its temple? No. It just uses it. Do you use your body? Sure you do. Are you using it wisely? No. You're not using it wisely. If you were using your body wisely, you'd say, all right, now, I have a dog, and my dog is a nice dog, and I want that dog to behave. So you teach your dog to behave. You teach your dog to mind. You teach your dog to come when you call him. You teach your dog to sit. You teach your dog to do these things. And you say, oh, I'm being so mean to my dog, making him do things. No. Are you mean to a baby because you teach them how to potty train? Or do you want the baby to be unpotty trained for all of his life? He sits in the living room on the Davenport, you know, and he lets it go right there on the Davenport, you know. Is that what you want? No. You train them. Now, is that bad or good or anything? No, it's just part of the game of life. It's convenience. It's convenience. Now, is that death? Is the child going to die because you train him or don't train him? Possibly. Somebody see him messing up the house by not using the bathroom, they shoot him. It's you don't do that in here. My goodness sakes. When weren't you trained to go to the bathroom in your home by your parents? Weren't you trained to do things? Well, see, you train a child, you train a dog. What are you training in the dog to do this? Are you training the dog's spirit, mind, and soul to do this? or are you training the dog's body to do this? When you, dog, have a bowel movement you want, go outside. When you, dog, have a urine movement you have to make, go outside. And so they take the body outside, and it does its duty outside. The child takes their body in the bathroom and does it in the bathroom, in the toilet. Now, we don't think a thing about, it is not the body, it's not the mind and soul that are being trained, it's the body. The body is our vehicle for living our life. Now, it is presumed by every person who has ever lived that their body is their reality. Their body is the truth about them. And your body is not the truth about you. Your body doesn't even begin to reflect your original purity and integrity. Your body will reflect your original purity and integrity when you begin recognizing that your body wants to do what you want it to do. When you say to your children, you do this, you do that, you do the other thing, the children say, stick out the tongue at you. When you are a good role model, your children will follow suit. Your children will do as you do, not because you tell them, but because that's the way we do it in our family. Your body is your child, so to speak, separate from you. Your body does what you want it to do. Now, if Sybil had the intelligence she was born with, she would feed her body only the finest food. Now, Sybil, don't answer me, but what is only the finest food? The most expensive? The special food from a special place? Is that what it is? No. What it is? That's okay. You're getting attention from the other students and stuff like that. But your body, you're going to pour water for everybody or you're taking it out? You can be very distracting, you know that. And that's not what you intend to do. No. So, no, that's okay. We're dealing with something that's really not important, life after death. So, Sybil says to her body, you are my temple of the living spirit. You are the temple of the essence of me. Sybil says to her body, here is my engine. Here is my brain, my computer that operates my car. Here is the engine that operates my car. Here are the facts of the car. I can take another chassis and put it over my car, and it'll operate too. That same stuff, the inner workings, the inner essence, the spirit, mind, and body of the body is forever. Now you say, well, an engine is more than just a physical thing. It's less than that. It's you can't talk about it like that. Yes, you can. We're talking about it for our own experience right now. So, the body, if Sybil were to say to her body, look, I respect you. If Sybil were to say to her body, I like me, I like me, I like me. I drink the purest of water. It can be sewer water, but I drink the purest of water. The only water that goes in my body is the purest of water because it goes through my mind, my filtering system in my spirit, mind, and body, my spirit and mind first. I eat the finest foods. They go through my filtering system too. Only the finest foods. It doesn't matter really what the food is. It only matters that she thinks it's the finest food. You understand that? Okay. Now, this we're getting to the hard part now. You say food and water and air and so on isn't the hard part? No. This is the hard part. She says, I think only divine thoughts. I think only absolute, magnificent, beautiful thoughts. I think my original purity and integrity thoughts. That's what I think, she says. Now, do you think her body is perhaps going to give her a longer run than the average when she thinks like that? Do you think that her body may be a Moses body, or maybe a Noah body, or maybe a Methuselah body? 1,000 years? My goodness sakes, who wants to live 1,000 years? In your ideal spirit, mind, and body, you live 1,000 years and you have a ball. Your body doesn't have aches and pains. Your mind doesn't have limitation. Your mind doesn't get old. What is it that scientists tell us is a way to keep our mind young? Anybody? Do crossword puzzles. Keep the mind busy. Get the mind engaged. Don't retire from life. If you retire from life, then your mind is going to go ape on you. It's going to go out. If you do not stay active with your mind, it doesn't mean you have to work for a living and stuff, but stay active with your mind. Have your mind be participating in life, be active in life. Get yourself a computer. Get yourself a crossword puzzle. Get yourself all the games. You know, I used to think that playing games on the computer was a waste of time. And I still, in a way, do. But people who play games on a computer are only geniuses. Only geniuses play games on a computer. Because they get the computer to do anything they want it to do. They play games. I was sitting with a fellow on the airplane coming down, and he had his computer out, and he was taking his computer and going like this here and going like that, tilting it, you know, so that the ball would run around on the computer screen and do all these things. And he was just lickety-split going through all that stuff, and he finished it in a short time and showed it to his wife. His wife says, yeah, okay, you're always quick at that. And then he took out a different game. In the period of no more than 10 or 12 minutes, he had played about 5 or 6 full games on that computer and won them all. Now, what sort of a person was I sitting next to? I was sitting next to a genius. I was sitting next to a very bright young man, a very brilliant young man. And he didn't like to speak English. He just liked to speak German. He apparently was from somewhere in Germany when we left him off in Frankfurt. But he was marvelous. Now, true, he was a young man, maybe 32, 37, and what was he doing? He was a genius, and anything that could come to his hand, he would do it. If it was a game, if it was learning how to whittle, if it was learning how to play any kind of computer game, if it was learning any of the computer programming, he was a genius at it. Now, do you think he's going to stay young? You bet your life he is. Now, will his body remain available to him into old age, so to speak? Yes. There'll be no old age. He'll be a young man all of his life. He'll be dynamic, vital, dynamic, alive. He is taking his brain, that's part of his physical body, the tool of the mind, the tool of the spirit, mind, and body, the brain, and he is making it be virtually alive and alert and aware. Now, when you do that, you live a longer life. Now, you say, do we have to die? And we don't have to die, but also, we pass into another dimension without dying, taking our body along. Oftentimes we do that. And usually we do it by drowning in the ocean or something like that. And you can't find the body because the body didn't die. You are lost in the wilderness somewhere and your body is never found because it's never died. you moved into another dimension of life, which meant you left this plane here and moved perhaps a quarter of an inch in space to the other plane. On this plane that you are living on right now are many dimensions of life. There are many levels of consciousness right here and now, right in front of us, and we don't even know it. In this room, many people come to tell us who are psychic and who are sensitive and aware of those type of things. They say, in this room, it is packed with so many existences, so many lives, and yet not tumbling over each other because they are not aware or touched by the other lives that are there. Now, if Sybil walks through her living room here and goes out the front door, and she goes through around and about maybe 200 or 300 people, but she doesn't even know they're there. So do those people disturb her? No, not at all. She's not concerned. Now, if Sybil would sit down and say, okay, Herb said that that's the way it was. Now, let's see if he really is right. I'm going to check Herb out. Okay. Mind, you know about these things, so reveal them to me. I'm going to close my eyes. I'm going to open my eyes when you tell me. And when I open my eyes, I want to see a couple of dimensions of life. You know, you're ordering life around like that? Sure, why not? That's what it wants to be. It wants to be ordered around. It wants you to know all these things. These things are not secret. These things are not something known only to special masters or special people who have studied that stuff. It's available to everybody. But you don't know it. You don't know it because you haven't been interested. And also because you didn't have the guts that Sybil has. Sybil treads where angels fear to tread. And she does things that angels fear to do. Because, why? Sybil is just a little higher than an angel. And she's one of the upper muckywucks of the angels, and she's undisturbed by the lower echelon of angels who are still afraid to do things. And she's afraid to do nothing. And she goes out and lives her life so fantastically, so joyously, so fully, so completely, that she lives forever. Now, Sybil is everywhere. Now you say, Sybil, why don't you go and visit Samuel? See what Sammy's doing now. And Sybil says, I'm really not interested. He and I had a great relationship. We had a good life together. Now he's off on his journey, his vision, his trip. Why should I bother him? Maybe he's got a couple of nice girlfriends, you know. Who knows what he's got there, you know. Why should I disturb him? Why should I be disturbed? Go back to mine and say, Sam, why did you leave me here? Take me with you. And no, that's not her thing. She's doing her own show. Each of us are doing our own show. And our children may come and go. Our husbands, wives, our mothers and fathers may come and go. It's immaterial. Now, do you have the opportunity to go and be with them if you want? Sure. Did I tell you the story about Sylvia and her brother? I'll tell you. Sylvia had a younger brother that she dearly loved. And he was married and had children, and he had an illness and died. And she was very devoted to him and very happy with him and loved him very dearly. And so when he died, this was like maybe 10 years later, she said to me, several times in that, but she said to me, Herb, I would like to go and visit my brother. I said, really? She said, yes. And we had her counseling. We were in a mobile home, and we stopped at a park by a lake, and she wanted to have this visit. I said, okay. So we lay down on the floor of the mobile home, and we did an out-of-body journey. We did an out-of-body journey to visit her brother. And we went to visit her brother. And I gave her a guided out-of-body journey, and we went to have this visitation, had a great time. But it's not what you think it is. It's more interesting. We were in the Himalayan mountains, and we were up on the side of the Himalayan mountains. The blizzard was blowing. You couldn't see 2 inches in front of your eyes. And it was really something cold. And here, Sylvia and I were dressed in our Southern California clothing. And it really didn't matter. We were out of body. But then I said, okay, Sylvia, right here. And she says, what's right here? And I said, your brother. What do you mean he's right here? I said, walk in there. And so we both walked through this nothingness of the blizzard snow, and all of a sudden, boop, there was the most beautiful jungle garden you could ever imagine, up on the side of the Himalayan mountains. Just beautiful palm trees, beautiful coconuts, beautiful everything, you know, just really nice. And so we walked around a little bit. There's a little creek running through a cave and other lovely things. It was just, you know, like someone, it's the ideal jungle garden without the stuff that scares you to pieces. So Sylvia said, where is he? I said, well, call for him. And so she called him, and then a voice said, hi, what do you want? You know, that's his paradise, his alone paradise, and she invaded it. And it's Sylvia. I've come to visit you. And he says, oh, okay. And he was naked, living in his paradise, absolutely without anything. The temperature was absolutely perfect. Everything was perfect. Everything was ideal. Creation of his mind, you know. Everything was just the way he wanted. It's what his dream was. And so they sat and talked for a couple hours. And then it was time to go. And he says, well, it's time to go. You know, I got to get back to my thing of being me. And so, I mean, her brother telling her it's time to go. She missed him, you know. She wanted to talk more with him. She wanted to know what he's doing, what he's thinking, and which is none of her business. And so, then she says, can I come back and visit again? She says, do you have to? What a way for a brother to talk. Do you have to? And she says, no, but I would like to. He says, well, if you must, you can, but only if you must, you know. I'm not entertaining people of past lives. I'm not entertaining my families of past lives. You're not the only past life I've had. I've had lots of past lives. I've had lots of experiences and existences, and I have chosen this paradise for myself. Well, finally we left, and we emerged back at the motorhome, and Sylvie says, wow, that was great. Roland didn't recognize me at the beginning. I said, well, you didn't recognize him either, because he was so pure, so perfect. The illness that he had had was nowhere in evidence. It was just not there. His whole body was a body of light, a body of purity, a body of wholeness. And, oh, wow, you know. And I walked away from them and let them talk, but then we left. And she says, he is fantastic. And I said, well, why are you interested in knowing what he's doing and knowing how he's doing and having your nose in his business? Well, because I always did. And I said, maybe it's time not to do that anymore. Maybe it's time to let him go where he wants to go and do what he wants to do. He's a big boy. He can do what he wants to do. Let him alone. Now, how she responded to that, I'll never know, because we haven't talked about it since. But she says, I'll have to do something like that. But, you know, and I'm not interested in knowing what she's doing. But that experience was there for her, and she never believed it could be possible, but she never disbelieved that that experience happened, because she had it. Now, I've done that with several other people and gone on out-of-body journeys with them for different purposes, but the thing is, that's not my choice. I've long since left those activities long far behind. And now what I do is I just live in my ideal spirit, mind, and body. I live in my ideal spirit and mind, and I leave my body out. I leave my body out because my body is its ideal, original purity and integrity. Whatever my body was designed to be is what it is and what it always will be. I don't need to take it with me, or I can take it with me, depending upon what my pleasure is at any given moment. And I can have you know that it has gone with me, or I can have you know that it's here. I can leave it behind, if that is my choice. And I have left nothing behind except the auto body that I took off of my old Rolls Royce and put a new one on. You know? Why not? Why not? This is what life is all about. And this is the beauty of it. And this is how it functions for us. Now, your question was, please, what can you tell us about life after death? Is it true, really, another realm where people who have passed away can exist? And, of course, your question is, okay, but when you know what we do when we leave this realm, then you have a whole different attitude about things. When we leave this realm, we are going to another adventure. We're not dying because our body was so rotten and so bad. That may have been an excuse, but not really. If you are really a spiritually illumined being, you will have a spiritually illumined body also, and it might tag along with you where you go, or it might not. It makes little difference. It makes little difference at all. Sometimes we leave our body behind and we try to have some illness or disease that makes us realize we have to leave it behind. But what is our body? Is our body a symbol, an ideal? Is our body the physical thing that we look at? Or is our body just an image? This is another story. If I go on to that, it'll start us on a most interesting journey, and we will miss our next lecture. Maybe I'll use it for the next lecture. Holographic bodies exist. And holographic bodies are utterly fantastic. Let's answer your questions before we take off on our next journeys here, because they're fascinating. Is there anything one can do for a loved one who has passed on under painful circumstances to ease their journey wherever they may be? And I say shit. A person who dies with an ill body is merely making it easier for you to release them. They want to take their next journey, and you won't let them go because you love them so much, or you say you love them so much. If you love them so much, you'd let them go. So they have this ill body, and if you won't let them go, then they make it a painfully ill body. But I guarantee you, they did not feel any pain. They did not feel any pain whatsoever. Why should they inflict that upon themselves? They're doing this for you, so you will release them and let them go, and let them go to their next fantastic experience. And that's what we do. We hang on to people. Now, we cannot help a person who has moved on. We cannot help them. All we can do is one thing, which we should have done before they left. Let go. Let them be. Your child is crawling on the floor, and he gets up, and he wavers around, and you want to run to him to catch him before he falls, and you don't. you tie yourself to the chair. You go, no, you don't let him. And so he falls, and he gets up, and he falls, and he gets up, and he falls, and he's not hurting himself. And by the time he gets to you, some 10, 15 feet away, he's learned how to walk. But if you had gotten in there and bugged into the situation while he was learning to walk, it would take him a week or a month or longer to learn how to walk. Maybe he'd never be skillful at walking because you got your bloated nothingness in the way of the divine circuits while he was trying to find his way to do the most natural thing life offers. So think of that. Think of that. We're doing that entirely too often. Is there anything one can do for a loved one who has passed away under painful circumstances to ease that their journey wherever that may be? If you want to make the journey of your loved one an easy journey, take off the apron string. Take off that cord you have tied to them. Can you imagine your son going to Boy Scout camp or going to camp, and you have a rope tied to his leg so that you'll always have control of him? And then he's on the train or the bus, and the bus leaves, and you got the rope hanging on here, and then you're sliding along the pavement going along with him. What a difficult time that boy would have. And you know what would happen? His buddies would say, "You want that rope on your leg?" And he said, "No, that's my mom, you know. She's always worried about me." And the boys would say, "Well, I am a scout second class, and I have a knife. Shall I cut the rope?" "Oh, yes." And so then he cuts through the rope, and Mama goes rolling in the ditch, and she says, "Woo-hoo, my boy." And you want to let go. We don't let go. We're hanging on to our children and not letting them grow up. We're hanging on to our husbands and not letting them be a success. We're hanging on to our wives and not letting them have their own experience in life, which is wonderful. Here we are in Nigeria, and the majority of our audience here are male. In the United States, the majority of the audience is what?
Female.
Because the men don't really care. The women are the ones who are interested in their spiritual life. The men are interested in their business life. Very few of the men have a great interest in the spiritual life. It's true. Now, this is a little aside and not very pleasant and not very bad, but why do men wear... Oh, I shouldn't say that at all. Okay.
Right,
what?
Move on.
Well, I was just...
Forward.
Up?
Oh, you want to hear it.
Good.
Forward.
Oh, forward. Okay. I was looking at your calendar up here, and the calendar was Lord God Almighty standing there in his robes. And he is the Lord General of the Lord everything, you know. And he is the Pope of Nigeria, apparently. And he's wearing the beautiful robes. And why is it the Catholic priests all wear robes? And why is it the laity of many churches like to wear robes? And why is it the choir in church wears robes? And why is it? Because they're playing the game of ladies. Because they're being a lady. Because the ladies are the ones who are interested in their spiritual life. And so they're being a lady for the ladies. Now, you say, "Herb, that is outrageous. That is stupid." Now, why would you say a thing like that? Well, I have to be careful here in Nigeria saying it because many of you wear robes too and in your everyday affairs. And like Ben here, Ben's got his big black robe on and he thinks nobody notices it. And his big black robe is more noticeable than the other robes which blend into people with the simple robes. But now, is there anything wrong with the Lord God Almighty fellow up here of your church wearing this robe? No, not at all. What is he telling you? He is telling you that it is his feminine side that he is projecting and working on. It's his feminine nature. It is his spiritual nature. It is his uninhibited nature of being the divine. You say, that's pretty good. Yeah, that's pretty good. Now, whenever men are wearing robes of one sort or another, as priests in the temple or what have you, or just Nigerians, and you're wearing these robes because you enjoy them, that's perfectly okay. But remember, you can't hide the show you're putting on. The show you're putting on is you want to outpicture your feminine nature. And your feminine nature is your spiritual nature, the nature of divinity within you, uninhibited. Now, we could talk for hours on that, but that doesn't satisfy anything. I'm just telling you that's good, and let it alone and take it from there. But remember, whenever you see someone playing a role, putting on a robe, acting on stage, they're not the real character. You know that. They are play acting. And the priests are play acting. The Pope is play acting. All these people, and that's not bad. I mean, it's rather good to play act in a positive spiritual way than it is in a negative way. But it's still play acting. Now, what would you think of an artist, an actor, who acts so well that you think he's the original thing? What would you think of that? That's acting quite well, isn't it? Acting quite well. But is that what he wants to do? No. He wants you to know he is John Doe, the actor, pretending he's Shakespeare, the playwright actor. And he wants you to believe that he's Shakespeare, but he wants you to remember that he's John Doe, because he wants you to give John Doe the Academy Award, not Shakespeare the Academy Award, for playing Shakespeare. Because Shakespeare didn't play Shakespeare. John Doe played Shakespeare. And he was the actor, and he wants to... Now, why didn't John Doe, which he can do, be the actor of the play of his life? Why doesn't John Doe go out there and be such a superior John Doe, such an amazing, sensitive, loving person, John Doe, that everybody who sees him says, wow, what a marvelous person. What a beautiful person. On the video on the plane, they had a story about a young man who played rough roles in on the screen with the television shows he was in. He was always the robber, the crook, or the bad guy. Because in real life, he had been caught by the Boston police 20 times for robbing things as he was growing up. You know, man, oh man. Well, then all of a sudden, he won the Academy Award for being a bad guy. He knew how to play it so well. And he says, I don't want to be the bad guy anymore. I do not want to be the bad guy anymore. I mean, he's an amazing boy. And his wife and children, his little children, about 10, 8 years old, standing next to him in the picture, they wanted him to play the new role too. And so he starts playing the new role. And he played the new role as a fine quality type person who can see through problems and see through circumstances in a most dignified and magnificent way so well that he won the Academy Award for that. And he won the Academy Award for being a bad guy, pretending he was, and then he won the Academy Award for being a good guy, pretending. But he didn't stop at pretending. He started a philanthropic fund for young people, I think, to have something or other, medical help that they might need. And he took up golf, which he had never taken up. And when he took up golf, he gave it the same intent that he did in his acting. And he's ready for the PGA in one more year. And he's only doing it part-time. But he's good, because he has learned how to play golf. And he's learned that to play golf, you put the ball where you want it to go. You don't wish the ball to be where you want it to go. You take the club and you strike the ball and you put the ball where you want it to go before you hit it, and then you look at where you're putting it, and that's where it's going. Now, that's the way to play golf. That's the way others who have done very well play and accomplish it. But this young man, I heard him on a short clip, and he was so humble. He was so sincere. He's maybe 32 years old, something like that, or less. So fantastic, so reputable, so glorious. You just had to say, wow, he is really a good fellow. He had a beautiful modulation in his voice. He had a beautiful stature. He had a good physique. He maintained his figure very well. He wore clothing properly. He looked very good. Now you, what's your role in life? Your role in life is not who you are, who you were, who you want to be. Your role in life is who you is. Who are you this moment, and only this moment, and every moment like that? And when you find out who you are, and then you act that way like this young man did and does, you will be an Academy Award winner every time, but not for acting, for living it. And when you live it like he does, he's an amazing... I don't know why I watched it. I don't watch any of the stuff they have on these things on the video from the plane, because usually it's a lot of violence. But this thing happened to keep coming up on between the seats and here and there, and it just had a charm, a secret silent charm about it that I couldn't hear, that made me say, listen to see what it's all about. And I tuned over to it, and I was glad I did. You see, a lot of times we run away from things, and in running away, what happens is that we also miss the good stuff. What we have to do is to be selective. Be selective. And when we're selective, then we are the winners. We get an Academy Award for playing the role of being Sybil. Who do you think could play the role of being Sybil the best? Sybil?
Sybil.
And she did, and she is, and she was, and that's always the way it'd be. But what about any of the rest of you? Could you play Sybil the way she does? You could, with practice. But what would be missing? One word. And I don't mean life spirit. I mean spirit. Her spirit of being herself and having fun. Her spirit of handling everything in a very noble and genuine way. Her spirit of being a glorious, gracious, fantastic woman. If you don't have that, you can't play her role. You can't be her role. And the same for all the men here. Each one of you has spirit about you. Each one of you will probably die and leave your body behind and go off to adventure after adventure after adventure until the time comes that you stop running away. You stop saying, I'm getting out of that old body because it doesn't do it for me anymore. I'm getting away from that old body because it's no fun anymore. I'm going to get a new body. You stop saying that. And you start saying, I live in my ideal body. I live in my ideal world. I live in my ideal everything. And then you do. But you don't until you make the decision. Do you want to die of an illness? Do you want to die of unhappiness? Do you want to die of a world that has forgotten you? You want to die a pauper? Do you want to be a great, beautiful artist who paints the most wonderful paintings in the world and not have any money during your lifetime? Have your relatives all have the money from your paintings? Is that what you want? Is that what you want?
No.
This is what we do to ourselves, and this is how we mess up ourselves. Okay, let's see what her... That was the last one she had here. Okay, and then here's two more. Okay. All right. My question, what are the ways I can create inexhaustible finances? Well, you create inexhaustible finances by stopping thinking that you're poor. When you think that you're poor, you can never have inexhaustible finances. Do you know some of the richest kings in the world were paupers? They didn't have enough money to finance their wars. They didn't have enough money to maintain their kingdom. They didn't handle money well. They did not know how to handle money, how to use money, how to live with money, and therefore they were very poor. They were financially independent. They could have been, but they didn't handle it. People do that. We do that. I said the other day, we spend hundreds of thousands of dollars sending our children to school through their lifetime, and we don't recognize that we are spending that money because we're ferreting it away, piddling it away for little things that have to be done, buying books, buying uniforms, buying clothes, sending them to school, doing these things, having their lunches, having their doctor bills paid for, having their teeth fixed and doing all these things. By the time you get done with raising a child from the beginning and through college or until it goes off on its own, when it's off on its own, it's not on its own anymore. You're still there. They still come home and say, can I borrow some money? You know. But this is what you create. You create. Now, you spend the money. You have the money. You are financially independent. You always were. You always will be. But you tell yourself that you don't have it. You're just a bad counselor for yourself. You're a bad business manager. And when you're a bad business manager, you're terrible. Ellen manages our books on campus, and she manages them so beautifully. She makes sure that if it's 30 cents off, she's got that balanced out. Why is she 30 cents off? And one place she was 9 cents off because the check said $11 and 00, and 10 looked like 09. And so she thought that 9 cents had to be accounted for, and it was not accounted for. But once she had it taken care of, you see, she makes our books just do wonder things. We pay our bills, we take care of our responsibilities. We are not excessive, but we are very, very competent in handling these things. Or I should say, she is very competent. Or I created her as very competent in doing it. And our financial affairs are taken care of. Richard Bach, whom you all may know, who wrote Jonathan Livingston Seagull, if you don't know him and you haven't read that book, it'll be the delight of your life. At least it was to my son and myself and all of our students. And in Richard Bach, he tells about Jonathan Livingston Seagull going up to heaven and saying to Sully, who was there, he said, Sully, where is everybody? I thought heaven be flocked with seagulls. And Sully said, no, John, only those who are ready to move on higher pass through heaven. Heaven is not a place. It's a state of consciousness. And you see, then what did he do? All of a sudden, for the first time in his life, he had many million dollars for the sale of his books. And he hired a business manager that he did not know. And he told the business manager to manage his money. And it was not through a bank or not through anything, but this person was a recommended person in him. Well, within about 3 months, all of his money disappeared. Just disappeared. And Richard Bach was a pauper again. He had no money. He had bills that he had brought up that he didn't have money to pay for. So Richard says, okay, I will get someone who can handle my books, can handle my stocks, can handle my finances intelligently. And so he found through a bank someone to handle his money intelligently. They did not make him the big money that the other person was supposed to have made for him, but didn't. But they were secure. And when he balanced himself out, then he wrote another book called Illusions. I think that's what it is, isn't it? Yeah. Handbook of Ascended Masters. No, is that what it is? No.
Yes.
No. Ascended Masters? Yes. No. Handbook of Messiah. The Messiah's Handbook. Illusions, the Messiah's Handbook. A very fascinating little book. Really beautiful. And he made a buku million off of it because he made more off the first one. It helped to make it second. Well, then he had good direction on his finances, and he was never bothered by finances again because he didn't go out and try to con other people by going for the fast buck. He handled it just beautifully. Well, he worked on it, but he had to let go of his attitude about himself. He had to let go of his feeling of superiority. And of course, the minute he let go of it, then he started writing books that had no value to them anymore. But c'est la vie. Okay, what are the ways I can create inexhaustible finances? You create inexhaustible finances by recognizing that you are all money. You are independently wealthy. You are the source, and you are the substance, and you are the essence of all the money, all the value in the world. And it's just up to you right now to claim it, name it, claim it, and experience it. And the minute you do that, you have it. But if you keep living mentally in a household that's poverty, you will always have that. Your physical household is not your consequence. It's your mental household. If your mental household is a household of poverty, illness, problems, worry, then your whole life is shot. If your mental household is one of spiritual illumination and abundance and joy and harmony and peace, then you've got it made. And this is what you do. This is the answer to what are the ways I can create inexhaustible finance. You create inexhaustible finance by recognizing that right now you are independently wealthy and totally fantastic. Okay, we have another question here. We answer it right away. How all of you who take this course today, this seminar, will receive a practitioner certificate. And that means you should know about practicing the principle to accomplish good health, wealth, happiness, and harmony in every area of your life. Now, this question says, how does a practitioner respond to any situation that fails to yield in a time of need? For example, if you plan to get an orange in a particular orange tree, and you went there and find none. Well, you're just talking about the Hindu boys who were trained by their master to create a tree that has oranges on it, but the oranges were pure illusion. And if you want to play that game, you can play that game. It doesn't matter. But you see, the master came along when this boy had gone before his friend, said, "I'll create an orange tree for you." It's in India. And so this friend says, "Oh, sure, you can. You learn that? Oh, hey." So he creates the orange tree with the oranges on it. And the kid says, "Wow." And he runs over to the tree to grab an orange, and the orange is nothing. And the master is walking by, and he sees this. And he sees that the kid's making a fool out of himself. And so the master wiggles his nose, or whatever a master does, and the tree has real oranges on it. So the next kid runs up to the tree and grabs an orange, and he says, "Ooh, it's a real orange." Well, later, the master talked to his student, and the master said, "When you are not ready to perform, don't perform. Prove your performances to yourself, and when you can do it for yourself, then you can do it for others. But don't go out showing off just to have people think that you are something you're not." And this is what happens to each of us. when we want to go out and pretend that we are something that we're not, we're in trouble. Does every orange tree have oranges on it? Yes. Does every orange tree that ever exists anywhere have all the oranges that it can possibly have at all times? And do the oranges reappear constantly even when they're picked? Yes. Is perfect health ours at all times, even when it appears not to be there? Is perfect health always ours? Are we always perfect? Are we always fantastic? Always, even though the appearance might not be there? Yes. If you think, because the appearance is not there, you are not healthy, if you think for one second that that's the case, then you've lost the game. You've lost the battle. Were you going to say something? You moved your hand. Okay, that's fine. Okay, Prishtay, you understand? It's wonderful, isn't it? Okay, now. We were going to... our last discussion was taking us into the idea of creating. And I think we've pretty much talked about creating and how we create. So, it's time for us, past the time, right? to go on with our next lecture. So we will do that, and you can all enjoy that very much.